Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hey everyone, it's Serge from Libre Lounge. Unfortunately, Chris is still up on the mountain working on some crazy, awesome, interesting code that I'm sure that they'll want to share with us when they are back. But in the meantime, we are very lucky to be joined by Phil Higelberg, who is known online as Technomancy. Welcome, Phil.
Thanks. Thrilled to be here.
So I will talk about how I got to know you. You've apparently done everything. So you've done multiple types of programming. You've written games. You've done hardware. I first encountered you, I want to say back in 2004-ish, when I got involved with Clojure. And Clojure is, for people who may not be familiar, is kind of a modern Lisp in the style of Common Lisp and Scheme and Racket, but with a lot of new ideas that were brought up then, and you had written the packaging system, essentially.
Right, yeah. So in the aughts, I guess we're calling them now, I was just getting started with Clojure, and we're all kind of just getting started with Clojure. It was maybe a year or so after it had first been released, and I'd gotten a job working in Clojure and really found the lack of tooling to be kind of problematic. And so I was lucky enough to be able to have the ability to work on a project like that while I was at this job and put together Lion Again, which is which really took off and has been kind of like the de facto project tooling for Clojure. So that's kind of where I got my start there, and probably the most widely used piece of software I've written.
Yeah, and I think it might be fun to explore a little bit about why Lisps are interesting and why Clojure is interesting, even though neither of us use Clojure right now. My understanding, and it might be wrong, was that was really your first real use of a Lisp for serious work. Is that right?
Actually, I got into Lisp first with Emacs, and there's kind of a funny story there, because what drew me to Lisp was that whole idea of the thing that sets Lisp languages apart. Lisp is, a family of languages. So you have this idea that you can have code that operates on code, metaprogramming, and Lisp just makes that a lot more seamless than most languages do. When I was in 8th grade, I think, I wrote some text adventures in QBasic on a DOS machine that my roommate had, and I didn't have any background in programming, of course, it was in 8th grade, but I wanted to write a program that could let you manipulate a text adventure game, and I ended up writing something that could spit out code for a game that you could walk around in different rooms and stuff, but I didn't know nearly enough about data structures to make it actually make sense. So I just had it emitting, print, you are in such and such, kind of just really awkward way of structuring it, and it didn't work at all, really. But then when I read about it later in college, I felt like, ooh, this really appeals to me, because it has that that self-referential magic, and that's kind of what hooked me. Of course, I don't end up really using that very much. It's a neat trick, but it's not the kind of thing you pull out all the time. What's really stuck with me with Lisps is the idea of developing interactively and being able to almost like have a conversation with your code as you're writing it. I feel like there's just something magical about that style of development that draws me and makes me not want to give that up or try any other language that doesn't at least offer that model of development.
Yeah. I think that Lisp, for all of its flaws and I'm pretty critical of Lisp sometimes, but the composability element is unmatched in any other language that I've tried. Just the ability to take a statement and being able to composably work with it on the editor. I guess Haskell people might have some ire for that statement, but I think that it's just easier to develop components and pieces in Lisp and have more assurance that they're going to work when you combine them with other pieces. So for people who don't know, Lisp, you know, has this allure. It's a programming, it's a family of programming languages, you know, with its origins in the 60s. It's one of the oldest languages. I think it's the second oldest language currently in use, second only to Fortran. And it was the first language to introduce if statements, and it was the first language to introduce garbage collection and all these other kind of very modern features. Yet it was built in the 60s, and it's extremely, extremely simple. And it's very famous for its use of parentheses. So it felt like Lisp had, while it was still in use, a lot of the language design elements had either come by through committee or had kind of just withered away. The work that was being done was very incremental and very much kind of the way it felt was it was designed not to upset any of the past. And Rich Hickey came in and said, okay, I'm throwing all this away. I'm building a new modern Lisp with a whole bunch of radical ideas and very different syntax where he allowed objects on the reader that were, you know, vectors, so arrays rather than just lists, and also famously hash tables. It ran on the JVM, so you had interoperability with other libraries. And then a very different idea of a concurrency model baked right into the language, which had a lot of strong opinions on how you should be programming. I don't think we want to make this a closure episode, but I do think it's important to mention how exciting that was for a lot of us back then, that there was this kind of radical work being done. And I know for me, it kind of reinvigorated my interest in Lisp.
Yeah. And really the big thing, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things there, but the one that made it stick is the fact that you could use it on the JVM, the Java Virtual Machine, which meant suddenly, you know, I mean, before Clojure was released, you had plenty of programmers interested in Lisps and using them on weekends and evenings and stuff for fun or to write, you know, personal tools and stuff. But it was very unusual to see anyone doing that at their day job. It's pretty rare. And so Clojure was, by situating itself on that platform, allowed it to kind of be brought in, snuck into these shops that, knew how to deploy, the JVM and used all these libraries on the JVM, but suddenly could bring in the Lisp and kind of get the best of both worlds, whereas previously had been, you know, they've got their own foreign runtime that has, you know, different set of libraries and not very good interoperability.
Right. And I think that was a pretty radical idea, which was, hey, instead of trying to reinvent all of the libraries, everything in the world, we're just going to rely on the existing libraries in the Java world. And look, there are, you know, a gazillion libraries for Java. So why reinvent them? And that made so they also put out a version of Clojure for JavaScript called Clojure Script. And it was interesting because I felt like it was a lot, in some ways easier to use because you didn't have the overhead of the JVM. But then on the other hand, you also didn't get the full benefit of the concurrency models that you got in real, you know, quote unquote, real Clojure. So that was interesting, but I felt like at least at that point, it was, a move toward, making this not just a little tiny project, but a real language.
Yeah. I haven't actually really used Clojure Script much. I don't work in the browser much, but, That is when Foreclosure first came out, one of the common criticisms from other Lispers who had gone the more traditional route is, you know, Common Lisp is a language, one language that has a spec and it has multiple implementations of it. And the same with Scheme, there's a document that describes Scheme, and then there's, you know, 10 or 12 different people, or 10 or 12 different pieces of software that implement that. And Clojure was just an implementation with no descriptive document. And it still is that way, but the fact that there's no one standard for what defines what Clojure is, but the fact that it has been, you know, ported to many different runtimes, even though they're not really cross-compatible necessarily, it gives it a little more sway to the folks who would cast that criticism, for what it's worth.
I mean, for me, there was an interesting argument also with Clojure Script that basically at the time, you know, JSON was still vying for public attention against XML, and Clojure Script proponents were arguing that Clojure on the reader, so, you know, basically Clojure being entered in through a text document, was a better idea than JSON because it had more types. I think today you'd have a hard time making that argument because we have things like JSON-LD, and JSON itself has become kind of an accepted de facto standard far beyond JavaScript. So, you know, at the time you didn't see as many libraries in other languages that just implemented JSON, whereas today everyone pretty much agrees that, you know, JSON is an interchange format. But it was an interesting argument. And I actually did know people that wrote Clojure Script code and made full applications in Clojure Script. So it was actually used for real things, as well as just being a nice alternative. But, you know, and I'm not going to speak for you. I'll speak for myself. I guess I turned off of Clojure at two distinct points. The first is when I realized that by using the Eclipse license, that it precluded me from writing GPL code in Clojure. And I had assumed for a long time that this was, a mistake that would get corrected, and, learned subsequently that this was not, a mistake, but in fact, specific design choice by the Eclipse licensed developers, that they had made this choice on purpose,
yeah,
and that this was not going to change.
I am still using Clojure at work, actually. For my day job, that's my bread and butter, but I used to do a lot of it in my free time, and I don't really do much of that anymore. And it's not exactly for the same reason, but it's definitely related. I think for me, maybe a decade or more ago, well, no, when I was in school, when I was in university, I read about the free software movement and like, wow, this really speaks to me. I want to be part of this movement that, you know, uses software as a form of mutual solidarity and, you know, is focused on sharing code because of the cultural and political benefits that gives. But being maybe a little bit naive, I saw the open source movement come along and say, hey, we're going to use these same licenses as the free software movement, but we're going to do it for completely different reasons, having to do with, we just want software that works better regardless of the political outcome of that. And I kind of bought into that for a long time. And, it took me a long time. I slowly came around to the fact that actually, no, these are really different things, and, you know, free software and open source. And if you, they happen to use a lot of the same licenses, but the goals are very different, and spending all your time, free time working on open source is great if you want to use it to get a job or something, but it's not this kind of, it's not this social good that I kind of came into it thinking it was. So it took a while for me to realize that, and kind of once that sunk in, realized like, oh, actually, you know, this is not something I want to be spending my free time on. I want to pick projects that are a little more strategic. I still maintain Linegan, but it's very much in maintenance mode at this point. It's got the features it needs, and there's the occasional bug fix, but it's not a big investment of my time right now.
Yeah, I mean, for people who may not know, Linegan is used for creating a project, so it's kind of similar to pip on Python or maybe cpan sort of on not quite on Perl, and maybe npm or at least the package.json component of JavaScript development. So it's a core piece of using Clojure for real projects. So it's, as you say, it's pretty important. I have a lot of thoughts on this open source versus free software thing. We've talked about it multiple times on the show. You know, I guess I will say I also think that it didn't just fail for developers. I think it also failed in some ways for companies. You know, open source was sold as a way of getting people to work on your stuff without having to pay them. You know, it was like, well, you just sprinkle the magic open source dust, and then people are just going to work for you and you don't have to pay them. Isn't that great? And I think in a lot of ways, the open source movement's selling that as a feature has in some ways soured people, because they say, well, that doesn't actually happen. And that's right. It rarely happens that a customer, or especially just a random person, is going to start working unpaid for a company. And then I guess talks to the other piece that kind of killed Clojure for me personally, which was, well, at first Rich Hickey was asking for donations to fund himself. And I actually was a contributor for a while to his personal fund. And then he started a new company, and eventually, this is a few years later, put out a post basically saying, well, you know, this open source thing is great. We, this company, produce Clojure and we give it to you, the community. But you shouldn't expect anything, right? This is a gift that I give to you. And those are my words. So you don't have to agree with the way I'm interpreting them. But for me, it really stung. And I was like, you know what? I don't actually want to keep using this software just because of that. But I'll say there were some technical reasons. The concurrency model in Clojure was basically built around the idea that you would have machines with lots and lots of cores sharing memory, and that machines were going to scale this way, and machines weren't taking advantage of all the cores. I feel like we've in many ways kind of hit that limit. Like, okay, so we have more, a lot of machines have lots of cores, but that's not the thing that in many cases is breaking our concurrency. And yet, in order to get that concurrency model, Clojure introduces this idea of immutability by default, and pretty much strictly immutability, where, you know, variables have to, they're basically constants unless you very, very consciously and explicitly go through the process of changing them. They can't just kind of be casually modified. And I thought this was brilliant back, as you say, in the aughts, but I've kind of come around, and languages that have used, you know, the asynchronous model, like, you know, like JavaScript, like modern versions of Python, like Go, have kind of shed that idea as well. The idea is, well, actually, you can do quite a lot of work with just a single thread, and if you deal with just one thread, you don't actually have to worry too much about this concurrency thing. And usually your concurrency issues can be handled at some other abstraction layer. And I don't remember if we've talked about the actor model on the show. Chris is a really huge proponent of the actor model. And it's a very different programming model than the concurrency models that Clojure has. So for me, you know, the community, the license, the community, and then the concurrency model kind of made me turn my back to Clojure for a long time. And I know that you have started a very different Lisp called Fennel, and I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, ironically, when you say that talk about the concurrency model and the way that Clojure embraces, or the way that Clojure chooses to address scaling, it's actually really tied in with, in my opinion, I see a lot of convergence with that problem of open source versus free software, because Clojure is, like, from the bottom up, built around the assumption that you're going to be running it on these big beefy servers, and you're just, you know, the Java virtual machine is very memory hungry, and it kind of makes a lot of assumptions about being the only program of consequence running on the machine. So when you're working in a startup and you're deploying to your servers, that's fine. Like, you're putting the JVM is essentially the whole thing, the whole server. But when you're writing software for people to use, like on their computer, that doesn't fly at all, right? You can't just tell people, like, yeah, run this big old JVM and it's gonna run as if it was the only thing on your machine. Hope that works for you. It's got a terrible startup time. Like, that doesn't fly, right? So when I, for me, in my experience, it works great at my day job, and it's a perfect fit there. The kind of problems that bother me about it don't apply there. But when I'm taking a step back and I'm talking about, oh, what do I want to work on personally? What am I going to choose to spend my time on? It's not going to be the kind of problems that, you know, a Silicon Valley company has. It's going to be problems that real humans have. And for that, I feel like you don't want that baggage. It's just not a good fit. So what I've been working on more, in the past couple of years is the programming language called Fennel, which has a lot of parallels to Clojure because it's a Lisp. It's superficially very similar, just in terms of like what functions look like and how you bind variables and things. But the other similarity with Clojure is that it's hosted on an existing virtual machine. So Fennel is a compiler that targets Lua and runs on, you know, anywhere that Lua runs, which turns out to be an awful lot of places. The canonical Lua virtual machine implementation is 200 kilobytes. So it's very popular to embed inside a larger program, and that, what you get, you start to get it used to add programmability to larger programs that would otherwise be somewhat inflexible or, you know, maybe in a larger program written in C, you would have to download the whole thing from source and recompile it, and it's going to take like 20 minutes if you want to make a minor change. But if you can embed something like the Lua virtual machine inside your program, then suddenly it becomes, you get that instantaneous feedback. You can reprogram it on the fly without restarting anything. And it's a fantastic fit for that. And that interactivity, that immediate feedback, is something that I value very highly. It's one of my favorite things about programming. And so that really appealed to me as a place to work on a language.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess for people who don't know Lua, it's a very small, very tight language. But what's great about it is that it runs everywhere, and it makes it very easy to work, especially interoperability with C and C++. It's got great interoperability there.
Yeah, so that's another big reason why people reach for it when they're looking for a language to embed in a larger C program.
So does that mean Fennel also has those same calling out benefits where you can just say like, okay, I don't want to have to rewrite this, but there's a C library, so I'll just talk, I guess, through Lua to C.
Yeah, it does. And one of the things that makes Fennel very, very different from Clojure is that it is strictly a compiler. It is not, it doesn't have any of its own runtime. So when you compile a Clojure program, you get, you know, Java bytecode that the Java runtime can't, it doesn't know the difference between the fact that it came from Clojure or the fact that it came from Java. It's just, we've got this bytecode, we're going to run it. But that Clojure code can't run without Clojure itself being there to depend upon. But when you compile a Fennel program, the code you emit will run completely standalone on anywhere you can run Lua without bringing Fennel into it at runtime. So that gives it a lot of reach.
So it gets compiled. Does it get turned into Lua, or does it just get directly compiled into the Lua bytecode?
Yeah, so we actually did source-to-source for this because there are so many different implementations of the Lua VM. And they don't all share the same bytecode format, so being able to use the source allows us to run on the 200 kilobyte, you know, reference implementation on Lua JIT, which is like consistently ranks at the top of, you know, your benchmark shootouts for languages, on the JVM, on .NET, on Go, you know, any of these. The Lua VM is so simple that it tends to get ported a lot.
So, for someone who doesn't really know much about Lua, does that also mean it's got some kind of source mapping so that if I'm debugging, I can say, well, actually, this error came from this line of Fennel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's two approaches we can do to that. Like, one of them is if you keep the Fennel compiler resident and you're developing it interactively, we can actually emit a stack trace that, you know, replaces those line numbers for you. If you're doing ahead of time compilation, there's two different ways you can compile to Lua. You can compile to, you can have your Lua output be pretty printed and look indented as if it was written by a human programmer. And that actually looks, there's a couple places it looks weird, but like, it's not unusual to compile a piece of Fennel code and to see the Lua output and for it to be, you know, completely what a human would have written in the same, like not to not look weird at all. But you can also emit the Lua so that the, like, it preserves line by line, correspondence with the Fennel. So you don't need any kind of source mapping. And I implemented that as, like on a whim, thinking it would like kind of work, but be really janky, and it works surprisingly well, because Lua and Fennel are so close to each other semantically. There's, you know, Fennel brings in some new concepts, but they're all concepts that apply at compile time. And so the input and the output tend to be structured similarly, even if the syntax is different.
So you mentioned targeting multiple Lua VMs. Does that include Fengari, the JavaScript Lua implementation?
It does. Actually, if you go to fennel-lang.org, you can see there is, like, right first thing as it loads, there's a REPL, basically a console where you can enter Fennel code. And a lot of times what happens with those kind of things is it sends it to a server somewhere to get evaluated and returns the response. That doesn't happen here. We actually run it in Fengari, which is a line-by-line port of the C version of the Lua Virtual Machine to JavaScript, and it works. I think the only change we had to make was, of course, the standard REPL assumes that you have, you know, print, that you have a console available. And so once we made that change to wire it into this HTML form, HTML elements instead of standard in and standard out, it just did the thing. All the complete final test suite passed in the browser. I was shocked.
That's amazing that it just worked like that. But that's a credit to the code. So I'm going to ask from Clojure, there were a few other things. We talked about the concurrency model. The other big thing from Clojure, especially for someone who's not used to a Lisp, is that object orientation in Lisps tend to use generics rather than in the inheritance model that people are used to. And so I'm a little bit curious about how Fennel handles that.
Sure, yeah. So Fennel, because it's a language that has no runtime footprint at all, everything is done at compile time, which means we can't really introduce anything. We can't introduce anything that's not in Lua unless it is a compile time construct that can be expressed in terms of Lua without any kind of third-party libraries. And that means we do what Lua does, which is give you the flexibility you need to construct an object system, but not include it in the language itself. So it's very common for Lua programmers to build a class system in, you know, a couple hundred lines of code that has method dispatch, but it's not part of the language itself. So that's it's typically done similar to JavaScript with a prototypal inheritance system. It's called metatables in Lua, and it works if you're into that kind of thing, but I've never really found it to be all that valuable, so I just don't.
You just don't use objects, or you do something entirely different?
I don't really like the term object orientation, just because it brings together several different pieces of different concepts under one umbrella that I don't think really belong under one umbrella and are a lot more interesting to talk about in isolation. Like the idea of encapsulation is very important in Fennel, but we use it solely, we encapsulate solely through closures, through, you know, lexical scope. And that gives us that particular benefit of object orientation without objects. And that's a pretty common technique in languages that have, you know, first class functions and proper scoping. So encapsulation is there. You know, you can have, an object that is, so in Lua it would be a table, a data structure that has both data and functions in it. And you achieve that in Lua by just putting the function in the table as a field. And then calling it. And there's a little bit of syntactic sugar for that. Just, you know, the method is just another field, just like any other string would be inside the table. And so that gives you that particular angle of object orientation. If you want to build some kind of generic interface where you call, you know, the .foo function, and on this object it does this, and on that object it does that, you just do that by putting a different function in the foo field of those two objects. And so it, you know, the complex object hierarchy really feels like you're overthinking it.
And then I guess you've got some kind of, so if you're talking to Lua and Lua's talking to C++, I guess Lua's got some kind of interoperability syntax, and I guess you've got your own that you use when you're making that leap.
You know, I could really tell you much about the C++ interop. I know the C interop is top notch, and especially in LuaJIT, is considered one of the best foreign function interfaces around. But I don't really know how that plays into objects in C++. Unfortunately, I've never had to do anything like that. Part of what makes Fennel work so well is that Lua itself has just chosen kind of the sweet spot of features to implement. Like, they say this about Scheme a lot, that it just takes away features that aren't necessary and just gives you only the features that are needed so you can build your own of whatever you want. And I think in a lot of ways it's true of Scheme in a very mathematical and academic sense, but I feel like it's true of Lua as well, in a sense that ends up feeling more satisfying in a practical, when it's applied practically. And so, like, the Lua language is just relentlessly simple, and part of that is it only has one data structure, and that's the table. So in Scheme, there's only one data structure, and that's the list. And I feel like JavaScript and PHP have maybe given that strategy a bad reputation because
theirs is the string.
No. I mean, they have, you know, JavaScript has the object, and it's really just a big hash table that you put things in. And even an array is an object. Like, an array isn't, it's just an object that happens to use numeric keys. And if you want to stuff a string key in there, you can do that. And it, you know, there's various reasons why that ends up being unsatisfying in PHP and JavaScript, but Lua doesn't put in a lot of magic, and it takes some getting used to, but really there's only one data structure ever, and that's the table. And whether it's sequential or associative depends not on the data structure itself, but on how you access the data structure. So you can go to a table and say, okay, loop over this as if it were a list, a sequence, like with numeric keys, or loop over this as if it were, a dictionary, key value pairs, and they both work, and it's not inherent in the data structure. So we ended up supporting, you know, curly braces for key value as a way of creating a key value table, and square brackets as a way of creating a sequential table that only has numbers, like increasing numbers, consecutive numbers as its keys. But really that's just different notation for the same result, basically.
That's interesting, especially for someone like me who hasn't used Lua. That's an interesting abstraction that I hadn't considered, and obviously lends itself well to a wide variety of programming styles. So definitely something I need to take some time to look into. So you've done other things.
I'm sorry, actually.
I want to get to.
Before we move on from Fennel, I want to make sure I clarify something. Because I heard you mention earlier that I was the creator of Fennel, and that's actually not true. I'm one of the lead developers, but the original creator of Fennel is Calvin Rose, and he created it like in a 2-week period back in 2016, and just this incredible tiny gem of a compiler, and then kind of forgot about it for several years, and I stumbled across it and started opening issues and making suggestions for things to do to it, and then he picked it back up and we started working on it together. So I just wanted to not take credit for something I didn't do there. So
no, that's a good thing. But you revitalized it and are taking you're a heavy contributor.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about hardware, but I also know that you've built a few games, although I'll be honest and say I don't actually think I've played one of your games.
Sure. Well, that's a nice segue from Fennel, because that's what I use for most of my games. I originally got interested in Lua when I kind of took a semi-retirement from programming and ended up doing a lot of volunteer work, but I wanted to, you know, keep a few side projects going to stay sharp. And I started writing some games with my kids. I did a few early ones in Racket. And then when I found the Love 2D framework in that uses Lua that kind of stuck, and I really seemed like a good fit for the kind of games I wanted to build. So for a couple of years I did a couple games, just kind of side projects and stuff in Lua, and then when I found Fennel, it kind of revitalized that for me and brought me back into like, oh wow, I can do so many cool things here. So the first game I made in Fennel was for the 2018 Lisp Game Jam, and it's called Exo Encounter 667, and it's all about you play as an unmanned probe that crash lands on an exoplanet, and you have to kind of uncover the ruins of an ancient civilization and figure out what's going on with solving some puzzles and stuff. But I had tons of fun doing that, and that was kind of the first non-trivial Fennel program I ever wrote for the game jam, and that ended up taking first place in the jams. That was a lot of fun.
Wow. That sounds really fun. For people who might have missed it, I mean, we'll have it in the show notes, but you want to repeat that, the name?
Oh yeah, it's called Exo Encounter 667, and that's probably the game I'm the most proud of. I feel like it was the most cohesive and fun, and I remember the reason I could spend so much time on it is I was traveling on the week when the game jam happened, and I was in San Francisco, so I had a lot of like evenings in the hotel to myself. But when I was writing the story, I very distinctly remember going to JWZ, the Netscape employee who was also an Emacs contributor.
Yeah, he made Lucid, right? He made Emacs, essentially.
Yeah, right, exactly. So he ended up like just getting so sick of the Valley and working for a tech startup that he like bailed on Netscape and sold all his stock like 6 months before the .com crash and bought a nightclub. Well, he expanded it to also have a pizza place next to it, and which was right next to where I used to work at my previous job. So I go there sometimes, and my tradition is to use Emacs while reading his blog and watching the bizarre music videos that play at the pizza place, and he eat the pizza, which is not like great pizza, but it's a tradition. It's a thing I do. And I have a very distinct memory of like sitting down, having a vague idea of the story I wanted to tell, and like being in there for 3 hours and just like blasting out this story and like going back to it later and thinking, oh, I'm actually really happy with how that turned out. Like maybe all those weird music videos or whatever kind of inspired me or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's a very short game. It's, you know, game jams are necessarily pretty limited, so you can finish it in like half an hour, but yeah, you can check it out. I've done several other ones since then as well, and my most recent one is a game where you play as the operator of a transporter on a starship, and you have to like go on these missions where you beam people up without like losing their various particles into the ether. That one's called Energize.
I want to use some time to talk about the Atreus keyboard, or is it Atreus or Atreus?
Atreus, yeah. Atreus,
which is I've got one right here. I'm unfortunately not using it to type, but it's right next to me. And it's this little awesome keyboard that's clickety and with a kind of a different, first of all, it's small and compact, it's clickety, and it's got an interesting keyboard layout. And I'd love, and I know that you designed it in Emacs, so I'd love for you to talk about that a little.
Yeah, sure. So the pitch, I guess, is that it's a keyboard that's travel keyboard, mechanical keyboard, travel mechanical ergonomic DIY keyboard. So let's start at the top. Travel, it's, I bought a really fancy mechanical keyboard that I started using at home, and I just loved it. I loved the crisp response of the switches. I loved that it was very ergonomic, but it was big, and I work from coffee shops a lot, and it was really a drag for me to like pull it out and like try to find space for it. And so I wanted something that I could just throw in my bag and I could just put in my lap. I wouldn't even need to have space for it at the table I was sitting at, wherever I was, you know, at the airport, coffee shop, on the road, whatever. So that was kind of the first factor. Mechanical, it's, you know, it uses key switches where every key has a spring in it rather than being kind of the one layer of rubber that conventional keyboards nowadays have as a cost cutting measure. It's, you know, it's got a real precise key response to it. And for me, it feels very satisfying. It's ergonomic. It's, so if you look at a conventional keyboard, you see that the keys are arranged where every row is staggered from the other one, and that's, you know, if you've ever typed on a typewriter where the striking arms have to come up and hit the paper, you know that you can't align the keys in a way that you might expect because it would cause the striking arms on the typewriter to jam. But of course we don't have striking arms on our laptop keyboards, but they retain that same unfortunate design. So I kind of took a step back and, you know, if you hold out your hand and look at your hand, you notice that your fingers kind of go in an arc and, you know, your pinky is shorter and your middle finger is longer. And so I tried to make the keys, of the keyboard line up with the fingers that are pressing them, which you would think is not a very difficult concept, but, it's, unfortunately, quite rare. And then finally, it's a DIY kit, so you can build one, solder it together yourself, which I think is a lot of fun and can be pretty satisfying to get that hands-on experience.
Yeah, I know that's something we enjoy doing sometimes here. Although I bought the pre-soldered one, an early pre-soldered one from you, it was... So actually, for people who may not have seen this, but may have seen a more expensive and elaborate keyboard, the Keyboardio, which is also a quote-unquote open-source keyboard, it's similar in layout, but much, much smaller. Like, I can't imagine taking the Keyboardio out with me anywhere, whereas this absolutely could just go in a small, you know, in a bag. You've got a picture of someone in a within a jeans pocket. I don't know where these jeans come from because I don't have jeans with pockets that big, but it could definitely easily fit in a backpack or a messenger bag or I've got a man purse. Like it could totally fit in my man purse. So and it is really clickety. It does not impose any particular keyboard layout either. None of the keys have symbols printed on them. So kind of can invent that for yourself.
You can, so the keyboard has a microcontroller in it, which is an Arduino compatible. So it, you can take that and flash it with your own layout if you decide you want to add a layer or just shift around the keys and stuff. That's a big part. And as you mentioned, you know, it's the open hardware it's got an open hardware license. It's released under the GPL version 3. So, you know, that's a big deal for me for why I've been working on the project, that motivation. But it's funny because you should mention Keyboardio because, I'm actually working with them to do the next generation of the Atreus 2. It's going to be, slightly smaller version with a couple extra keys, and it's going to be, I'm working with them with all the expertise they have with supply chain management and things like that to start selling one that is significantly cheaper, because right now the volume is so low that it's really just the kind of business that I've been running out of my own closet, basically. And so that ends up, you know, being pretty pricey, especially for something that you have to still build yourself. And so the next version is going to be significantly cheaper working with their supply chain and all that experience that they got from, you know, building and selling their Keyboardio keyboard, which is also a really solid product as well.
It's funny that you mentioned the price, though, because I was thinking how inexpensive it is when you compare it to other mechanical keyboards, right? Like, mechanical keyboards can be hundreds of dollars, and the Atrius is only like $180. So I'm like, oh, it's a bargain. And I actually think it was still less than the Keyboardio, which, as you mentioned, had a much higher volume. I don't recall, because I was a Kickstarter to the Keyboardio, and that was a really long time ago, so I don't actually remember how much I paid. But I think that the Atrius was might have been less expensive. I don't want to, don't quote me on that.
Yeah. No, it is. But I mean, like, it depends, right, who you're going to compare it with, because, you know, you can spend as much on a keyboard as you want to spend. And so some people compare it to, you know, maybe something they would find in Best Buy for $50 and be like, oh, so, and the DIY kit is $150. So, you know, oh, why am I paying three times as much for something I, you know, have to put together myself? But yeah, when you compare it to, you know, a lot of the high end mechanical keyboards, the Keyboardio has this, big, like, hardwood maple body. So, you know, that adds a lot to the cost. It's really classy, but it also, you know, adds a lot of weight and stuff too. So we're working on getting it. Hopefully the fully assembled Atrius 2 will be significantly cheaper than the DIY version of the Atrius 1. So that's going to open it up to a much wider audience.
But it won't be a kit. It'll just be a fully assembled keyboard.
Yeah. You know, at that point, it doesn't make sense to offer it really as a kit necessarily. At least not through the factory. I may end up, continuing to sell a small number of those as a premium item where the kit actually costs more, because I can customize it. You know, I can do a wood case that has a laser engraving or something, if you have a logo or you want to put your name on it or something like that. I haven't really decided, but that's one of the ideas I'm considering.
But it'll have Cherry MX switches.
Yeah. Or, yeah.
Okay. So that's still pretty amazing. And so I'm just looking on your website, and then it looks like you're switching to the same firmware that Keyboardio uses, which I guess is a good thing, so that there's some convergence.
Yeah, they've got a nice tool that lets you remap it without, like, downloading GCC and stuff like that, like a GUI tool that is actually pretty slick. So that made a lot of sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. Wow, we've covered a lot. Is there are there any other projects you'd like to talk about?
If you're interested in hearing more about the construction and the design and the rationale behind the Atrius, there I gave a talk at RacketCon 2019 in Utah, and it goes into a lot more detail there. So I ended up using Racket to design the circuit board and parts of the case, and so talk a little bit about that there. But
is that talk online somewhere?
Yeah. I'll get you a link. You can put it in the
show
notes.
Okay, cool. And then we'll link to it in the show notes. Yeah, because I want to watch it, and I'm sure people listening are going to want to do the same. Yeah. So wow, we've covered a lot, and it's really been awesome having you here. I'm sure that our paths will cross again, because so many of the things we talk about in the show are things that you're involved in. But I think it's a good place to wrap up for now. So if anyone would like to send some feedback, our email address is podcast@libralounge.org. You can hang out with us on IRC on Freenode. We're #LibraLounge. We're on the Fediverse at floss.social. We're at LibraLounge at floss.social. We're on Twitter at LibraLounge. And I think that is it. And we will see you next time. So thanks, everyone. Bye.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibraLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joss, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on opengameart.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.